And welcome to the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm Phil Taylor. And today we're going to be talking to Professor Yakov Rabkin in Montreal. And halfway through the show, we should be talking to, and that would be about 5:30, we'll be talking to Thomas Mountain, who is a great favorite of many of our listeners, a very direct, frank-talking guy who is in Eritrea. He's we're going to call him our man in Eritrea. Professor Rabkin was in Toronto recently at the Science for Peace, and I should say it, the new modern way to talk about things, scienceforpeace.ca, and the issue was the possible war and a crisis around the Islamic Republic between Iran, U.S., and Israel. And it was very important, and I'm glad they had that gathering. There have been some demonstrations. So obviously, there is a continuing crisis around this question of Israel's intentions, U.S. intentions. Professor Rabkin has been writing about these matters for some years. I could tell you, you could go to, he has a great website, yakovrabkin.ca. where he has a number of very readable, very accessible, very thoughtful articles. And just by way of description, I'm going to continue with it. Yakov Rabkin is professor of history at the University of Montreal. After completing his university education, he studied Judaism with rabbis in Montreal, Paris, and Jerusalem. He's the author of several books and hundreds of articles. He specializes in the history of science and contemporary Jewish history. His analyses of Jewish, Israeli, and interfaith issues have appeared in electronic and print media, including Jerusalem Post, Jewish Chronicle of London, La Presse in Montreal, Midstream, New York, and Tikkun, Berkeley. His book is A Threat from Within, A Century of Jewish Opposition to Zionism. It's a terrific, very readable, very, very thought-provoking book. And I think we're joined now by Yakov Rabkin. Are you there, sir?
Yes, I am.
Well, thanks very much for joining us. You were in the city recently, and you were attending I'm going to call it a teach-in, where the issue was possible war involving Israel, the United States, and the Islamic Republic. And today's the headlines, I should say, I don't know why I'm saying today, for at least a week, have been a discussion of whether or not Israel might be interested in a preemptive attack on the Islamic Republic. And then the meetings between Mr. Netanyahu and President Obama, and it's like a steady cycle of front-page discussion, which I hope people are finding alarming that it's talked about this way, of possible attacks on the Islamic Republic. And let me start with this question, because I know you addressed it at the conference. In your view, in using the words of Netanyahu, does Iran constitute an existential threat to Israel?
No, it doesn't. And I think that most Israeli military leaders understand that just as well. I think that Israel has been very intelligent to raise the Iran issue while it continues the settlement policy and the taking of Palestinian land. Because of the Iran issue, the Palestinian issue has been completely eclipsed. And I think this may be one of the most important consequences of what's going on now. While we are mesmerized by the tension between President Obama and Prime Minister Netanyahu, something very important is happening in the occupied territories. There's a relentless settlement drive that gets very little attention because everyone is focused on Iran.
Mm-hmm. It could be, in other words, a little bit of calculation on the part of both the prime minister and the president, since that issue would be dangerous for President Obama to be talking about, right?
Exactly. And I think, as someone put it, the issue is not weapons of mass destruction, but weapons of mass distraction. They're being distracted into something very different. I don't think that Israel really considers a military strike, but politically it's extremely important to raise the tension and to present Iran as an existential threat. I think we have to realize that Israel has several hundred nuclear bombs and Iran has none. Iran is under the control of the Atomic Energy, International Atomic Agency, Atomic Energy Agency, while Israel is not. So, if anything, Israel possesses a much greater potential of destruction than Iran. But unfortunately, the entire debate about Iran has been rather irrational, and it's interesting that the mainstream media often accuse Iran leaders of irrationality. But in fact, I find a lot more irrationality in the Western discourse about Iran, because, you know, just imagine if the United States were facing a hostile Iran, which occupied Mexico and Canada and has engaged in operations on U.S. territory with drones. How would the United States react to that?
Yeah, we, living in Canada, we have a rough idea. By the way, don't you feel, do you get the impression, this is that there's an anxiety, and I think you address this in your book, within Israel and then within the United States and certainly within Canada, there's really a profound suspicion of this whole story from the point of view of the population. They can't see why this, you know, that this, we do have this inflated rhetoric and threats since they, people don't actually believe that this is a problem that could needs to be addressed with weapons.
Well, I think that we reached a certain level of irrationality in the Western discourse about Iran and about Islam in general. Somehow the old colonial cliché is that we are rational and they are irrational, that we represent civilization and they're against the civilization. So the same very colonial discourse, I think, affects very much our current debate about Iran. And we forget that Iran has not attacked another country for 300 years, which is not exactly the record either of the United States or of Israel.
Yes. We're speaking to Professor Yakov Rabkin. He is the author of a tremendous book. I hope everybody is... By the way, it's in several languages. A Threat from Within, A Century of Jewish Opposition to Zionism. What about... I watch the... people from what they call think tanks, and I don't always know that there's never any evidence that they're thinking, but anyway, they're from think tanks, and some of them from spokespersons for support of Israel, and they really do like to use this expression over and over that the president of Iran has threatened to wipe out, wipe Israel off the face of the earth. I know you addressed that at the conference. Could you talk about that?
Yes, I wrote an entire article about that, which appeared both in English and in French. In fact, this is a bogus claim that he threatened to wipe Israel off the map. He didn't say anything of the sort, but it was mistranslated, which it was a quote from Ayatollah Khomeini, who regularly said that Israel... a state, a Zionist entity should disappear from the page of time. It's a rather poetic expression in Persian. I don't know Persian, but I have a graduate student who helped me understand this. So that slogan was all over Tehran for many years. But when Ahmadinejad repeated it, all of a sudden it became a wiping Israel off the map. Mm-hmm. And it was phrased, as you put it earlier, as an existential threat. I think this is an entirely artificial, media-created panic. But it didn't happen innocently. Mm-hmm. It happened by extremely devoted and very professional work of experts in Washington and pro-Israel bodies who distributed 13,000 press kits with the accusation that Ahmadinejad is about to destroy Israel. Mm-hmm. And they're not even addressing the issue that Iran not only didn't attack another country for 300 years, but it had never expressed any interest in engaging in war with Israel. And yet, that's what we hear. Another claim that we hear is that Ahmadinejad is a new Hitler, he's anti-Semitic. And again, it's a bogus claim, but totally bogus, because there's a prosperous Jewish community in Iran, and if he were anti-Semitic, I think he would have started with Jews who are Iranian citizens, but who are much more vulnerable than a country far away with nuclear weapons. That would make him really irrational if he had hit to begin with Israel.
Yeah, he would have emulated those in Europe who chose Jews as their political enemies in order to promote themselves to election, right?
Yeah, but he never made
an issue. That's never been an issue, as far as I know, in Iranian politics.
Absolutely not. And again, here we have people, including Prime Minister Harper, who completely bought the line of the Israeli government on this issue. So I think that what we need, the population, need, is some kind of rationality in looking at Iranian declarations, Iranian policies, and Iranian behavior in realistic light, rather than a propagandistic light that is now omnipresent in mainstream media. So today we have a very artificial framework for debate about Iran. We have hawks who want to attack it immediately, and we have so-called doves who want to strangle Iran and eventually cause war.
Yeah.
So it's a totally unrealistic framework. I think we have to break out of that stranglehold and discuss the issue as it is, namely that Iran is threatened by the United States. U.S. troops are in Afghanistan, in Iraq. Iran is, there's one-third of U.S. Navy now near the coast of Iran. All these are very bellicose actions.
Mm-hmm.
So I could understand why Iran would be concerned. And I could say, actually, that Iranian leaders have shown remarkable amount of restraint and patience.
Yes, there is a theory that the game is to prod them and prod them to make them do something which could precipitate violence.
Well, I think the violence can break out at any time, because when you have such a concentration of military power as the United States has near the coast of Iran, and they engage in really war-like actions like drones being sent over the Iranian territory, the terrorist actions that are being conducted on Iranian territory. So all these are acts of war already.
Mm-hmm.
So we're not talking about a future war. The war is already there, and that's why I keep saying that Iran has shown remarkable amount of restraint.
Mm-hmm. We're speaking to Professor Yakov Repkin. By the way, there's a great website, yakovrepkin.ca, if I got that right, where the articles on these matters have been published by the professor, and of course he's the author of the book, A Threat from Within, A Century of Jewish Opposition to Zionism. I wonder if I could just ask for clarification on when Ahmadinejad was the subject of this focused attack where they said, well, he's threatening to wipe Israel off the face of the earth, didn't he make a broader reference to the Soviet Union and to South Africa and said, these are countries that used to exist and they're gone?
Oh, certainly. No.
And he didn't mean that that he had attacked anybody to cause that to happen.
Yes, and he said it several times. In fact, he said the Soviet Union disappeared from the map without violence. And he really, in the best of cases, talked about regime change. He even said that what he really argues for is free election in Palestine and in Israel, and let the people there decide what kind of form of political arrangement they prefer. So, in fact, what he is saying is that there are people living under Israeli control that don't have any political rights, and they deserve to have political rights. So it's very similar to the South African situation. Not to say that what happened in South Africa is very inspiring, because the economic gap, I think, increased since the end of apartheid.
Mm-hmm.
But at least in terms of political rights, the discrimination has been removed. So I think that's what Iran Iranian leader, the Iranian leader has been saying that there has to be an arrangement found for Israel-Palestine, but he never, ever threatened military force.
Yeah. I want to ask, and this links to your, I want to remind our listeners, by the way, you lived in the Soviet Union, I guess, in what used to be Leningrad, now Petersburg. I think sometimes people want to call it Petrograd. I should ask you why they can't make up their minds. But anyhow, you lived there, you lived in Israel, you lived, in, and of course, now in Canada. And so you have a feel for what these great powers are up to. There seemed to be great anxiety or surprise, maybe, that Russia and China put their foot down in the vote on Syria, whereas they had let the matter of Libya pass somewhat. But this time they really came down rather sharply. And the reaction from U.S. diplomats was striking. They used words like outrageous. I think one of them said this was despicable. And what do you make of that? The vote itself, I mean, what were they voting? Why did they come down so hard in your view? And what's your analysis of that vote?
Well, I don't think the we have to interpret it as despicable, or in any case, we better see that China and Russia acquiesced to the Western attempt to protect, ostensibly to protect, civilian population in Libya. What it turned out to be is a bombardment campaign to overthrow Gaddafi and assassinate him.
Leading to very ugly results.
Right. So, Russia and China felt and feel that they were really duped, and they don't want to do that again. So, but I think most importantly, we have to realize that whoever doesn't agree with the United States these days is despicable. The United States has to fabricate enemies, and it did it with the Soviet Union. And now the archives of the Soviet Union are open. We know Stalin even never planned any military action on Western Europe. He never had any aggressive designs on the United States. But now we know it for sure. Yet, remember how great was the Red Menace in the United States.
And we had NATO as a result of that menace.
Exactly.
And it was going to go away.
And Lester Pearson played a very important role in founding the NATO, incidentally. But what is important is to realize that the United States used bogus claims, bogus assumptions, to promote its own strategic interests. It did it very successfully in the framework of the Cold War, being totally irrational about Soviet threat. They are doing the same thing now. They did the same thing with Iraq. And now they're doing it with Iran. I think we have to see that as the same repetition of irrational discourse, which is not based on intelligence, which is not based on military assessment. It's based on political impatience with anyone who dares stand up to the United States.
Mm-hmm. Professor Rapkin, I notice, of course, the UN is quite an accomplishment, really. It's a place where countries are supposed to come together with mutual respect and all that. It is kind of disappointing, isn't it? I mean, to see language like despicable and whatnot thrown around. I mean, if a country represents its own point of view, that's its own point of view. They don't require this kind of to me, it's a violence-threatening kind of language. And I know you quote sometimes your articles, you begin with, say, something from the Book of Samuel where you say it's not by strength that we are victorious. It's can you elaborate on your thinking about how countries ought to treat each other?
Well, we live in a world where military force has played a very important role. And I think that the relationship between the United States and the Soviet Union is a good example how the United States, after all, respected strength, respected the prospect of mutually assured destruction. In fact, the nuclear weapons ensured that there was never a conflict between the United States and the Soviet Union. Today, the situation is slightly different because the Soviet Union doesn't exist anymore. And that fact alone is interpreted very differently in the United States and Western countries and in Russia itself. In Russia itself, it's seen as the greatest tragedy of the 20th century, as dismemberment of the Soviet Union by power-hungry Yeltsin and his allies. It's seen as a knife in the back of the Soviet Union, of a great country. It's never seen as a defeat in a Cold War. It's never seen as a collapse because of internal difficulties.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, the arms race that was imposed on the Soviet Union by the United States did bleed the country, particularly in the difficult years after the Second World War, in which the Soviet Union lost 27 million people. So the Soviet Union had to withstand a tremendous amount of pressure from the United States, and the United Nations were meant to mediate conflict. But I think more than the United Nations, the nuclear balance is what ensured peace between those two countries.
Mm-hmm. We're speaking to Professor Rapkin, and it's yakovrapkin.ca, and he's the author of the book, A Threat from Within, A Century of Jewish Opposition to Zionism. Professor, I know you have thoughts about this. Of course, you've lived in Israel. You've been part of the whole debate about the direction of the country, the leadership. One of the elements in our in Canadian culture now is involves some political voices who have chosen to say it's an apartheid system. And that has brought a heavy reaction with people being told they shouldn't have conferences in that name and et cetera. Well, what do you think of that debate?
Well, I think, again, we're discussing something which is a kind of biased framework, because in our country, as in any other country where they have freedom of debate, you can discuss whatever you want to discuss. And there shouldn't be any topics beyond the bounds. As far as Israel, whether it's an apartheid state or not, some people argue that it is. Some people don't agree with that. Certainly there are similarities. There are also differences. People who know better, like Desmond Tutu, the Archbishop,
mm-hmm.
Desmond Tutu thinks that Israel is an apartheid state. In fact, it's more. It has more serious violation of human rights than South Africa of apartheid. But the issue is not there. The problem is that Israel and Zionism have become such taboo subjects that there's such a stranglehold on free debate that, for example, some lectures have been canceled, some events were prohibited from taking place on some campuses. I think this is really eroding our tradition of free debate. Mm-hmm. And I'm not arguing that those who believe that Israel is an apartheid state are necessarily right. Of course, there are differences. But it is certainly a legitimate subject for discussion.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't, but I know, I understand those who don't want this to be debated, because for them, any criticism of Israel constitutes an existential threat.
Mm-hmm.
You see, this issue of existential threat mm-hmm. has been played up very much in pro-Israel organizations in Canada, the United States, France, and other countries. It's much less played up in Israel itself, because in Israel itself, the debate is much freer. There are quite a few, very few taboo subjects. And I've attended several discussions at the University of Tel Aviv and elsewhere on Israel as an apartheid state. There's absolutely no problem in Israel to discuss it. And in fact, former Prime Minister Olmert used the term, in Israel, it doesn't provoke any particular passion.
Mm-hmm.
But here, some of pro-Israeli organizations that are extremely well-funded and very active and very devoted in their actions seem to be a little bit more Catholic than the Pope.
A little like our Prime Minister, actually.
Oh, Prime Minister is to the right of Prime Minister Netanyahu, that's quite clear.
Yeah, Netanyahu ought to be worried that our Prime Minister is trying to push him into a lot of trouble that he can't get out of.
Well, it's another subject of what we have here in this country, and I'll be happy to discuss it some other time. But I think I think it is very important to understand that perhaps our government is the most consistent, the most coherent right-wing government in the world today.
Yeah. I'm afraid you're right. This is Yakov Rapkin. By the way, we really appreciate the time you're giving us, and it is your book is I hope we can, by the way, have a return visit sometime and talk a lot about your book. But I want to ask something that has always puzzled me. You point out in your book that with the rise of Zionism, the religious leadership, the Jewish leaders were not impressed and, in matter of fact, fairly hostile. And that this, in matter of fact, that they were in the majority most of, the early 20th century. What was the tipping point? And why do you now have people who were part of a community that was well grounded in their opposition to Zionism? Why did they go over? What caused the shift?
I think what caused the shift is the interpretation of the Nazi genocide in Europe. We know that 6 million Jews, or around that number, were massacred by the Nazis in Europe. This was a very serious tragedy for Europe and for the world. And I think that many Jews interpreted this as a need to have their own state. Definitely that was the Zionist program, to have a state for the Jews. Now, the only problem was that, as you mentioned, most religious and actually most Jewish leaders at the time considered Zionism a very dangerous enterprise, because to start, particularly the establishment of the State of Israel in 1948, against the will of the majority of the population of the country at that time, and against the will of all the surrounding nations. See, that was a recipe for violence. And so for many Jews, I think, in North America, the tipping point was the Second World War and the interpretation given to it. But the real enthusiasm about Israel emerged, I think, after the Six-Day War of 1967, when, for example, the Reform Movement became overtly Zionist, where it was staunchly anti-Zionist before. So I think that there is some inebriation with success that happened to many Jews after the victory in 1967. They felt identification with Israel. Also, what I think affected very much is the public relations campaign of the Israeli government at the time, that before Israel's attack on neighboring Arab countries, they also talked about existential threat. They also talked about being thrown into the sea. That was the term used then. Nothing of the sort, in fact, was planned or was possible. Israel was much stronger than its neighbors, and Israel preemptively attacked Egypt, destroyed most of its army and air force. Again, but it was framed as a threat to Israel, and therefore Israel was right to preemptively attack Arab countries and destroy the armed forces. So I think from that point on, most Jews in the world felt some kind of identification with Israel, even though I must say that there's a lot of disaffection from pro-Israeli causes among young Jews in the United States, maybe in Canada. I know that in the United States it's a very serious trend that while the older generation may be rather pro-Israel, but not necessarily entirely pro-Israel, younger generations are very critical about what Israel is, not only what it does. The very idea of a Jewish state or a state for the Jews is alien to most American young Jews, who see their Jewishness as a religion, as a spiritual heritage, as a moral heritage, as an obligation to fight for social justice and so on, whereas they see that Israel stands for somewhat different set of principles.
I guess that in final, if I could get to ask you just one last thing, there's also a renewal of a debate which some people said we weren't supposed to be having, but I know that people like Edward Said and others have joined it, which is the issue, and I'd like to know your thoughts on the one state, two state business. When you think about that, what's your take on the subject?
Well, I believe that people who live in the area have to decide how they want to live, whether they want to have 1, 2, or 24 states. That's
24 is a good idea.
Yeah, it's my... There are a lot of divisions among Jewish population, among non-Jewish population of Israel, and among the Palestinians, too. But I think what is... If we talk about the current situation in the territory, I think most experts would agree that there is no hope for a two-state solution because all of the Israeli settlements in Palestinian lands, the settlers constitute about one-sixth of the population of the Palestinian territory. And I don't quite see an Israeli leader withdraw settlements. And moreover, I think it would be even unfair because people were born there, have lived there all their lives. What I think, therefore, the one-state solution may be a more realistic scenario.
Yeah, and it wouldn't involve transfers of people, right?
Exactly. That would involve a tremendous shift in the mentality of the majority of Israelis, namely that Palestinians are equal. That would require a very serious shift.
That's like trying to climb Mount Everest, I guess.
I'm not.
But you're an optimist.
I do remember. Well, I think it's. You see, for many people, the fear, the talk about existential threat, the idea that Jews can only be safe in their own country, is very deeply ingrained, and it really has become a belief for many people. But both Jews and non-Jews, incidentally, the majority of Zionists in the world are Christians. The Christian Zionists constitute about 50 million people, and the number of Jews in the world is about 14 million.
Mm-hmm.
So we're talking about a very much more serious group here in Canada as well. The more you go to the West, you see a lot more Christian Zionists than you see here in Quebec.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea that there should be one state where Jews may eventually become a minority, which is a very possible prospect, is something that instills fear in the minds of many people. They forget, however, that Jews live as minority in the United States, in Canada, in France, and are in no hurry to go to Israel. And this, I think, is the best proof that Jews can flourish and live their Judaism, if they choose so, to do so, in conditions of democratic liberal societies where countries are not created for a particular ethnic or religious group, but are considered multicultural and multi-confessional. Canada is a good example of that. With all the tensions and divisions that exist here, Jews and other minorities feel quite comfortable here. So I think this is the most important fact to realize, that the majority of Jews today in the world who have the option and the means to go and settle in Israel choose not to do so. And they have chosen not to do so consistently. Very few American Canadian Jews settled in Israel. A lot more Israelis settled in Canada and the United States. That tells you something about the attractiveness of the idea of an ethnic state.
And democracy, I guess.
And liberal democracy. You know, with all the drawbacks we have, after all, we have principles of equality enshrined in our political practice.
Mm-hmm. Well, I thank you very much for that. Professor Yaakov M. Rapkin, author of A Threat from Within, A Century of Jewish Opposition to Zionism, and yaakovrapkin.ca. We really appreciate the time, sir. Look forward to talking to you again.
It was my pleasure.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye.
And I really do recommend this book. It's very, very readable. We're going to take a break and be back, and we're going to talk to Thomas Mountain.
From the roots up, CIUT 89.5 FM, Toronto, presenting the history and evolution of sound for 25 years and counting. CIUT 89.5 FM, Toronto.
And we're back. This is the Taylor Report. And we were just speaking to Professor Yaakov Rapkin, and I want to mention to you that you're listening to CIUT 89.5 FM in Toronto. You can write to us, Taylor, at CIUT.fm, and you can, of course, can hear our interview with Professor Rapkin and other interviews on our website, taylor-report.com. And shortly we're going to be speaking, we hope, with the mountain, Thomas Mountain in Eritrea. I just want to make sure I point out something, that a wonderful journal called Al Akbar, just put Al-Akbar, and when it comes up in Arabic, you'll notice a little English word, and you click on a word saying English, and click on that, and you can get some terrific, very well-informed articles. They point out that we don't have casualty numbers that are reliable. That won't be news to listeners of the Taylor Report, because we focus on this kind of issue all the time, since numbers are manipulated basically as a propaganda exercise, and particularly in this matter of Syria. My favorite line is to read the one that says the United Nations reports. I'd like to interview the United Nations. I'll bet he's an interesting guy. We never get to know who is behind these numbers. But the article on Akbar points out that they have about three sources, and the reporter called them all and to try to determine how they knew the numbers that they had, and was told rather honestly by most of the people that they weren't sure, and that, for example, when they posted a number, I think it was 7,000 or something, according to the Al-Akbar correspondent who went over some of the areas where the victims were, victimhood, I'm going to say, took place, included such places as the Golan Heights, where I think seven Palestinians who were living in Syria had gone in a confrontation about 6 months ago, and made the news briefly, and seven of them were killed. That would be by the Israelis. And they were put into the numbers of civilian casualties in Syria, just tossed in. And we know, for example, there are 2,000 military people in Syria who've been killed. And they are part of this general number that is being produced by the United Nations. That's not going to surprise our next guest, who's Thomas Mountain in Eritrea. You're there, Thomas.
Yes, Bill.
Thomas, I'm going to start you off on something that I've galls me, and I know you must be thinking about it. So where do these numbers come from that get thrown around? We're talking about, of course, this confrontation around Syria and the threats of war. And they say 7,500. Have you been following that? What is your opinion of where they get these numbers?
Well, I think there's some organization called the Syrian National Council or something like that that's based in London, mm-hmm. that's being funded out of Qatar.
Let me see, Qatar, that's, yeah.
Mm-hmm. I think they're relying almost exclusively upon them, and they're a pretty shaky outfit.
Yeah, this is, and yet it gets repeated. It's the main trick is to repeat it, right? In other words, sources say, and after 3 days of that, it becomes set in steel.
You just keep repeating the lie enough, and then everybody accepts it. It's just like many ways, like what they did in Libya. Yeah. They just keep repeating this lie.
Well, by the way, now let's talk about that. You, Thomas Mountain, published a great piece on what was going on in Libya during the NATO-assisted attacks, and there was mainstream media was continually saying that there was were African mercenaries, and you pointed out, and others, that the consequence of that kind of talk would be very ugly for African Libyans.
Libyans and African guest workers, yes.
Yeah. Now, you've seen I assume you've seen this recent video. Can you talk about that?
Well, which video are you referring to?
There's a video has appeared. I've seen it at Counterpunch, I think. I saw it on the site called The Angry Arab Monthly Review. It's of black prisoners in Tripoli, and they are bound. Their hands are bound very tight behind their backs, and they're on their knees, and they're being called dogs by somebody speaking Arabic, and being forced to eat a flag, the flag of the government of Libya prior to the takeover by the Benghazi people.
Back when there was a government in Libya, yes.
When there was a government. You remember when there was a government? Yes. We're now seeing all these months later, the violence is still being carried out against that population.
Well, it's, you know, that specific video I haven't seen, but there's no question that the Libyan, you know, the abuse and the massacres of both Libyans who are ethnically black and African guest workers in Libya are has been, you know, going on from the very, very beginnings of the uprising, so-called uprising in Libya, the CIA-managed thing that they started there. The But, of course, I had an article called Obama Supports Lynching of Africans in Libya, about how thousands and thousands of black Libyans and Africans have been lynched by these paramilitary racist paramilitary militias that are now fighting it out in Libya to see who's going to be the ones who are going to be controlling the loot there. You know, it's interesting, there's the national, so-called National Transitional Council that supposedly rules Libya, even though apparently only almost none of them actually live in Libya, that the leadership all spends most of their time in Turkey. It still has a secret membership. They won't even release all the names of the people on that so-called council.
They have not yet released it? You mean the ordinary Libyan's not allowed to know who's running his country?
Well, the council is still secret, and not only that, but the so-called council will not release how much funds coming in from oil, how much money they've been receiving from the trade in oil. So there's a lot of secrecy there, and it's pretty nasty. I mean, Libya is headed into, you know, it's just getting worse. It's getting impossible to deny. I mean, even Press TV has two journalists now that have been kidnapped by some of these paramilitaries that are roaming around Libya, fighting it out, particularly in Tripoli. They've come from all over Libya, and now they're settling in Tripoli. Mm-hmm. They're refusing to go home, refusing to give up the guns, and they're sort of turning into their own little mini warlords and death squads, and that's pretty much what a lot of us predicted when this as the fighting intensified, where we could see what NATO had up in store for Libya.
Well, and they're transferring the government, such as it is, has told the world that they're sending $100 million in aid to the Syrian their brothers in Syria. Where did they get the $100 million, by the way?
Well, supposedly they said, since our medical facilities have been destroyed, we don't have medical facilities, thanks to NATO, really. They said we were going to send Libyans who were wounded in the war outside for medical treatment. And it turns out it was just an excuse for all the friends and relatives of some of these top leaders to send 40,000 Libyans outside for medical treatment, including cosmetic surgery, which the Libyan government, so-called government, NTC, was billed $800 million for. And yet you've got thousands of people that have been injured in the war who are not receiving really even basic treatment.
My gosh. We're speaking to Thomas Mountain. I recommend all you have to do is write Thomas Mountain in Google and you get a bunch of great articles. Thomas, on the matter of the vote at the United Nations, my understanding is Eritrea abstained. Is that right on the big General Assembly vote?
On Libya?
Yeah. And no, I'm sorry. I'm shifted my ground here. On Syria, you had the Security Council with the Soviets. I call them the Soviets. Gee, Putin will get mad at me. Russia and China, they vetoed. And then the U.S. Decided to, it had enough friends in the General Assembly to get a resolution condemning the Syrian government. I noticed that the governments, actually almost all the governments, I think, of East Africa, or many of them, abstained. What's your thoughts about what's going on at the UN in regard to Syria?
Well, the Syrians, I think it's sort of, the difference between Syria and Libya was that Syria has got an army. Libya didn't have an army. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, Libya, all the fighting would have been over very early. I mean, it took about a month for the pro-government forces to get themselves organized and militarily and to turn on the so-called rebels in Benghazi, and they were just about to put an end to all that. And, you know, it would just pretty much have been over. But NATO came in and started massacring Libyans, so that was the end of Libya. But Syria's got a serious army, something like 300,000 men, and another 400,000 in their reserves. So, you know, and the Syrian army's always been pretty well-armed and equipped. So, on the other hand, Syria is ethnically much more diverse than Libya. Libya has a lot of tribes, but they're all pretty much, you know, Sunni Muslims and Libyans, whereas in Syria, they're led by the Alawites with the sect of Shia, and majority of the country is Sunni. So I think Syria is a very different situation than Libya, and it's starting to look more and more like Assad is probably going to survive all this.
Mm-hmm.
So, which I think, and in a sense, you know, one thing I think I don't think there's quite the taste for Syria as there is in, I mean, for the West to overthrow the Syrian government, there is in Libya, because in one sense, if the Muslim Brotherhood, basically, which is the opposition in Syria, comes to power, it'd be a Sunni sect, and they'd very much be, you know, against Israel, more militantly against Israel, which Syria's basically been very, you know, been at peace with Israel. It's been pretty good neighbors with Israel. There's been no real attacks on Israel coming from Syria across the border. And so in one sense, getting rid of the Assad government is might turn around and back. You know, the West hasn't been sort of ambivalent about all that. I mean, I don't think they've quite thrown their whole weight behind it. Like they made a lot of noise, but I don't think they've actually come out and done what they, you know, what they could have done. I think much of this, what's happening in Syria, is being funded by the Saudis and the Emirates.
Well, by the way, now what do you think about that? I mean, if they they've put in a lot of chips on the line here, and if they can't bring down Assad, I mean, it's the nature of a fight, right? If you don't knock the other guy out, you might be in danger. After all, you know, the populations have hardly been tested. We know in the case of Saudi Arabia, there is a rather large portion of the working population happen to be Shia Muslims, and they don't really like the ruling family. If they cannot succeed in knocking down Assad, you would think that he might return the compliment.
Well, I don't think Assad is so much a problem for the Saudis as the, you know, as Bahrain is. So I had an article, my last article is entitled U.S. African Command Reborn in Djibouti. Basically, you know, what I was proposing was that it's clear that the Bahraini revolution uprising is not going away. It's steadily getting stronger. And that, of course, Bahrain is the home of the U.S. naval fleet in the Persian Gulf. And it's become problematic whether the U.S. fleet is going to be able to remain in Bahrain, because the Bahraini people, if they succeed in this uprising, know who has been supporting their oppressors,
yes,
the U.S. And if the Americans have to leave Bahrain, the military, the naval base in Bahrain, where are they going to go?
Mm-hmm.
Where they got a base? Now, the, you know, African Command, which was U.S. African Command, which was established after September 11th, 2001, has not been able to find a strategic location in Africa. No one with any location of strategic importance, no African country would give Bahrain.
They have not in my backyard policy.
Right. So they ended up making the smallest country in Africa, Djibouti, which really isn't even a country. It's just literally a province of Ethiopia, which has got a French and U.S. base there already. They made them an offer they couldn't refuse. But the problem was this all kind of blew up when it turned out that the highlands overlooking, the mountains overlooking Bahrain were Eritrean territory, and members of the Eritrean Defense Forces took up positions there. So I had an article entitled AFRICOM's $6 billion fiasco in Djibouti, about how the U.S. had this $6 billion base plan there, and then all of a sudden found out that almost all of that future base was under threat could possibly be reached by long-range Eritrean artillery, which the Eritreans never put any artillery up there, but they made sure that their borders were secure because they've had a lot of property taken from them, a lot of territory taken from Eritrea in the last few years by Ethiopia. And so that put AFRICOM in deep freeze, but then it sort of, you know, this uprising in Bahrain put the matter back into on the front burner because the Americans have to have a fallback position. And, of course, the Horn of Africa now has become increasingly strategically important because the growing trade links between Asia and Europe is passing through the Suez Canal and the Horn of Africa. So, you know, in December, Leon Panetta, the U.S. Secretary of Defense, visited a little base, Camp Lemonnier in Djibouti. And then in January, the U.S. signed a users agreement with Djibouti, which basically allows the United States to build a multi-billion-dollar military base in Djibouti, turn the base over to Djibouti for their ownership, and then turn around and lease it back for 99 years. Excuse me. So I think, you know, the situation for the U.S. is pretty, you know, in terms of the Persian Gulf is becoming increasingly unstable.
Tenuous.
Well, the thing is, they can't just come in and, you know, the Americans approved the Saudis coming in and helping to try to crush the Bahraini people's uprising. The problem was that ignited an uprising among a small but growing uprising among the Bahraini's cousins, the Shia population of eastern Saudi Arabia, which is where all the oil fields are.
Yes.
So the more bloodshed there is in Bahrain, the more unstable the Saudi Shia population becomes. So they're kind of in a tough position. The Saudis and the Americans can't just unleash this, you know, fury of the mercenaries that the Saudis have sent into Bahrain, because that's made things worse in Saudi itself.
Yes.
And so there's this Shia belt that extends from Yemen through Saudi Arabia into Bahrain, into Kuwait, all the way across into Lebanon, that everybody, you know, starting to talk about, because the Saudi oil fields are based in the Shia population, which is, you know, maybe 10% of the country. Yeah. And yet,
and they actually work those people.
Well, the Shia, the population themselves are actually, you know, quite a oppressed population in Saudi Arabia. I mean, in a school, the headmaster of the school, any school for the Shia has to be a Sunni Saudi. It can't be a Shia. Yeah. They're not allowed in the military or the police forces. So there's a great deal of resentment, history of resentment by the Shia. And the thing is, the Shia in Bahrain are literally, they intermarry and literally cousins with the Shia in Saudi. Mm-hmm. So I think you know, the blowback in Syria, you know, of Assad surviving this attempted overthrow is, I don't think, is quite the situation. You know, is dangerous to them as what's really going on in Bahrain.
Yeah. Well, that's a good point. This is Thomas Mountain. And, Thomas, I must ask you now, we are getting reports in the Canadian media saying that Ethiopian forces have just recently had a successful campaign in Somalia. Now, what do you know about that? What are you thinking? What is the story there?
Well, you know, there was a lot of news about this so-called summit on Somalia in London. And basically, that was just an excuse to approve another surge of African Union troops. I mean, Yoweri Museveni of Uganda, who's got most of the troops in Mogadishu, has been campaigning for the West to fund an increase of, and that's what they've done. They're basically, originally there was supposed to be 4,000 African Union so-called peacekeepers in Mogadishu. And then it was 8,000, then it was 12,000. Now they're talking about close to 20,000 troops total.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's the, you know, this Somali surge now.
And that's bankrolled from Europe, right?
Yeah, that basically the Americans and the Western countries are paying for it all under the guise of peacekeeping forces under the African Union via the United Nations.
Mm-hmm.
The whole interesting thing about Somali, their quick review. You know, there was no government until 2006 in southern Somalia when the Union of Islamic Courts came to, you know, first time to Mogadishu for 15 years and began to bring peace throughout southern and central Somalia. And this was unacceptable to them, particularly the United States.
Oh, absolutely.
Because the Union, and particularly the Union of Islamic Courts, was headed by an Islamist named Sheikh Sharif, and they were supposedly linked to Al-Qaeda link. Now, so after 6 months in December of 2006, the U.S. sent the Ethiopian army in to overthrow the Union of Islamic Courts in Mogadishu. And the government headed by Sheikh Sharif, the supposedly terrorist-linked government, was overthrown. Well, fast forward to a year later, and the Ethiopian army is under, you know, growing resistance from the Somali population, starting to lose up to 100 troops a day. And the world went to sleep one night with Sheikh Sharif being the former head of the Union of Islamic Courts and Al-Qaeda-linked terrorist, and woke up the next morning to find that there was a new government in Somalia headed by Sheikh Sharif. That overnight he'd gone from being a terrorist to being a democratically elected president of Somalia, of course elected in Djibouti under the watchful eyes of the French and U.S. military. So, I mean, the absurdity of all this so-called government and external intervention in Somalia where, they overthrow a government headed by Sheikh Sharif and then install a new government headed by Sheikh Sharif, and they overthrew him because he was an Al-Qaeda-linked terrorist, and then reinstall him because he was a democratically elected president. A year later. So,
yes.
You know, that's sort of the whole thing has been a farce and a fiasco. But, you know, never mind. The Western media doesn't have to remember any of that. You know, we've got a democracy in Somalia and we have terrorism there. And the war on terrorism, again, is the war on the Somali people there. And the interesting thing is, you know, for all the claims that Eritrea is, the bogus claims and fraudulent claims that Eritrea is arming the resistance there, under the leadership of the Al-Shabaab movement, that's basically the Somali resistance to the first Ethiopian, now the African Union invasion and occupation, is basically very lightly armed. I mean, they're pretty much the armed on the black market in Somalia, and much of it's actually come either from the United States or from the African Union troops that are stationed in Mogadishu.
Mm-hmm.
They're selling their arms on the black market to get extra cash. They don't have heavy artillery. They don't have, any of the weapons they need to fight the increasingly heavily armed African Union troops. Now, when African Union troops come out from Mogadishu to attack the resistance, they come out with columns of armored vehicles of 100 to 120 tanks.
Yeah.
Wait a second. How are you going to fight 120 tanks supported by a dozen helicopter gunships with rifles and RPG and machine guns?
We're going to have to read Thomas Mountain to find out. I'm afraid we're going to have to go, Thomas, but you really drew a clear picture for us. I do appreciate it. Always great to talk to you.
Okay, Phil. Okay, Toronto. Nice to talk to you. Ciao.
All right. Thomas Mountain. And previously we had Yakov... Rapkin, I'm sorry to be... This is the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. Write to us, Taylor at CIUT.FM. Check us out, Taylor-Report.com. Carol, thanks very much, and we'll see you next week.